Accession number 30418, Mr. Eric Greg Robery, Rail 5. Now, before we start, you've looked at your dates, and you went to Padgate in March 43, then deferred service meant you didn't report to Lords till July 43. You were there about a month to August 43. Then at Bridge North from August to September, you think, and then at Yatesbury from September 43 to August 44, which you're pretty convinced of. Mm-hmm. Now, we've gone through how, you know, you got you made a sergeant signaller, mm-hmm. and how you didn't get your commission, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened then? Where did you go to then? What was your next move?
That was after Yatesbury. We had a bit of leave, and then we went on to what was known as AFU, Advanced Flying Unit.
Now, which one did you attend?
Well, it was at Staverton in Gloucestershire, between Gloucester and Cheltenham, and also at Moreton Valence. There were two airfields. We did our day flying at Staverton, not much of it, and then we went up to Moreton Valence, just up the road, for night flying on Anson's.
Now, you don't know the number of the army of the advanced flying unit?
Yes, though. I do. It's number 6 O in brackets.
Observer, yeah.
AFU, advanced flying unit. Number 6 advanced flying unit. That's all it was known as.
So what happened at the advanced flying unit? Is this where you formed up a crew or became part of a crew?
No, we didn't form a crew until we got to Desborough. That was operational training unit. We didn't do an awful lot there. At Yatesbury, we'd flown in Dominies, the de Havilland Dominie, which was rigged out as a classroom. I think there were eight of us in.
We've done that. So,
But at Staverton, we were flying. I think the two wireless ops or trainee wireless ops flew in the Oxford and operated the set.
Now, what do you remember of the Oxford? What were the characteristics?
The Oxford, I'd flown in one when I was in the ATC, yearly camp, and we thought they were great. They were, to us, they were fast. and they were called airspeed Oxfords. And we had longer flights in them. Some of the flights lasting up to 3 hours. And we were getting bearings from different stations and passing the on to the navigator, who had a route to follow, and it was a check on me as a wireless operator getting the correct bearing, being able to get in touch with the ground stations and so on. We didn't do an awful lot. According to my logbook, I thought we'd done more, but there were only two flights we did in Oxfords.
Any other flying at all?
Well, after this day flying, we moved up to Moreton Valence for night flying. We did an awful lot more there.
In Oxfords again?
No, Anson's.
Oh, so you mentioned that. I do apologise. Yeah, now, tell me about the night flying.
The night flying, this is the one where the flights were much longer. 3 hours, 25 minutes. That was a day flight, sorry. 3 hours, 10 minutes, 3 hours, you know, that sort of thing. 3 hours, day and night.
What would a typical flight be like? What were you actually doing?
Well, they were all cross countries. And it was one wireless op. And I think the trainee navigator, and the two of us worked in conjunction. He was wanting to know where he was. He had to fly a course that we were given. This one was from the base to Chester to Newton to Thiel to Stroud. That was the course we had to follow. And he had his, what they called a computer in those days, his maps, and he was wanting to check. He knew which HFDF stations we were flying over, and I had to get in touch with them and pass the where we were, the bearing onto him. We used to get two bearings, always from two different stations, and where they intersected, that's where he was. So that's the way we worked. You know, we did it in daytime and at night time, and that was really the start of real serious training.
Do you remember anything, any particular incident, or was it quite routine in the sense of not, you know,
it was
it went
routine.
Well?
It was routine. There's nothing in here. Different cross countries. They're all cross country trips. That was it. I did a total of 41 hours, 25 minutes a day flying there. And no, that was the that's the running total. But the night flyings, that's the first night flying we did. I did 16 hours, 5 minutes night flying. I probably did the same day flying there.
What did you think of the Anson? I mean, was it better than the Oxford?
It seemed to be a lot noisier. It had radial engines to start with. But it was a real workhorse. There was more room in it for my set, as far as I remember. It didn't seem as cramped, wasn't as streamlined. You could always tell it was an Anson if you were on the ground, you heard one flying over. It had a distinct sound because of the radial engines. But it was a good aircraft, you know, dependable. And
so anything else at number 6 AFU? How long were you there for? I should have gone.
Well,
you got there in September.
Until the last flight was on the 15th of October. 15th of November, 44. And the next entry in my logbook is at Desborough OTU, 1st of December.
So you probably got there in late November.
So that looks like we had a fortnight's leave. From there, 15th of, what did I say? Oh, sorry, 15th of October. No, that was the last flying we did there, 15th of October. Sorry, yes, 15th of October. And the first flight at Desborough was the 1st of December.
Now, what was Desborough? That was another operational?
No, this was OTU, Operational Training Unit.
I thought the previous one was an operational training unit.
No,
well.
It's Advanced Flying Unit.
Ah, right, sorry. Yes, of course it was, right. Mm-hmm. So, now, what number OTU was it?
Number OTU. No, just, oh, number 84 OTU, yes. It's, yeah, that's right.
Now, what were you learning, what happened when you got to the OTU?
The purpose of the OTU was to crew up. To form a crew. We were flying Wellington bombers from there, and we went there as a group of wireless operators, or signals really, as we were called, who were ready to go on operations, so we had to find a crew.
And what was the method they used to get you into crews?
Well, you went there, and for the first week at least, you just meet together in the mess, have a few drinks, you know, and there are pilots, navigators, bomb aimers, all, you know, gunners, and all the different crew members, all milling around, getting friendly with people, having a few drinks in the mess. And they'd come around, they'd have a day when we'd all meet together, and you had to go into a big, like, classroom place, and meet with the officers, and the pilots would give the officers a list of what crew they'd been able to gather and what they were short of, and then we'd all be told, you know, what the what the situation was. We'd meet again, somebody come around, oh, signaller, Are you crewed up with anybody? No, not yet. Oh, I want a signaller, you know. How do you fancy joining us? We'd meet the rest. And that's the way it was. Very informal, but...
Now, who did you... Do you remember who your crew were? I mean, it's a long time ago, I understand.
I do, yes.
So who did
I've
you form a crew?
I've got photographs of them. The pilot was an Australian called Reg Hayman.
Reg?
Hayman. H-A-Y-M-A-N.
And
he was an Australian.
What rank was he?
Air Force.
Was he a pilot officer or was he a sergeant?
He was a flight sergeant at that time.
Now,
what
was he like?
He's much older than the rest of us. He'd been in the Australian army fighting in the desert. And he transferred to training, and was trained as a pilot. He switched, his occupation, what he wanted to do. He was a slightly built fellow. To most of the rest of the crew, he was quite old. I've got some great photographs of him, which I'll find later. That was the pilot.
The navigator was
also an Australian.
What was his name?
His was Bob Robert. Robert. Robert McCaig. McCabe.
McCabe.
M-C-
and what rank was he?
He was a sergeant. He was also Australian, so of course I expect that's why the Australian skipper picked an Australian navigator.
What was he like?
He was not a hail fellow well met, not the sort of bloke who'd like a drink or two in the mess. He was a studious sort of bloke. He was actually a teacher in Australia, where he taught, and he was very conscientious about his job. He was doing a correspondence course to further his education, for when he went back to teaching. He kept himself much to himself, but he was a very nice fellow, a little bit older than the rest of us, but not as old as the skipper. That was the navigator.
Yeah, who
and
else?
He and I got on very well, because signallers and wireless operators have to. We work together in the aircraft all the time, you see.
Now who else?
Next we have the bomber. He was a Welshman. Vernon Rees.
Another sergeant, I presume. Are they all sergeants?
Sergeant, yes.
Rees.
Rees.
R-E-E-S,
yeah. He was a thick-set fellow, very energetic. He'd been a weightlifter and a cyclist, a racing cyclist. He had quite a few interests. He wouldn't stand any nonsense from anybody. He was married. He's the only one of the crew that was married. And eventually, when we got onto the squadron, he arranged for his wife to come up and live near the station. She couldn't live on the station, of course. But that's coming later on. But that's the sort of fellow he was. Married, settled, that sort of thing. That's the bomb aimer. Next we have two gunners. The mid-upper gunner was Howard John. John was his surname. He was a Welshman from Llangollen. Llanelli. Glamorgan. Used to play rugby. Very nice lad. He and I got on very well. Full of fun, you know, liked a few drinks, but never got silly or anything like that. Just a really nice fellow. The rear gunner was a lad called Maximilian Libozek. L-E-B-O-Z-E-C.
Hang on. Maximilian and
Libozek. L-E-Bozek. B-O-Z-E-C. And on his shoulder he had a flash Free French.
And what was he like?
Well, he liked to make out that he was a Frenchman. And he joined the Free French forces and is now flying, you know, for England. He couldn't speak a word of French, turned out later on. I think his mother was French. And we later learned that, well, we think what the story was, his parents were separated or divorced, and his mother reverted to her maiden name, never met her mother or her father, but the skipper met the father. His father was called Varnell, Marcel Varnell, and he had an orchestra in the Savoy Hotel in London. And Maxie Libozek got on very well with Reg Heyman, the skipper. And any weekend leaves we got, they shot off to London, the pair of them, because Reg Heyman enjoyed being in the Savoy and knowing the band leader there and all this sort of thing. Eventually, Maxie ended up in Australia and I think reverted to his father's name, because I found out he became the producer of Neighbours for Grundy Television. Found that out quite by accident. We used to watch it, you know, years ago. And it gave his name, producer, Max Varnell. I said, that can only be Maxie. We know he did go out with Reg Heyman after the war. As I very nearly did, actually.
Now, tell me about how you trained together. How did you... Well, let's talk about the Wellington next. Yeah. Which one was it? Wellington, do you know which make? Not make, which number? Because they've got numbers, haven't they?
Wellington
3C or
593
or no, I mean the type number.
No.
Okay. Well, just tell me about the Wellington. What did you think of it? As an aeroplane.
A heavy, lumbersome sort of aircraft, but reliable. Again, the layout was a lot better for all the crew members, because it was a heavier bomber. I was sitting this way and the navigator there, and we were right next to one another as we needed to be. The mid of a gunner was just behind me. The bomb aimer had a good position. The bomb aimer, by the way, always used to operate the front gun turrets. There were bomb aimers and gunners as well. And they had planes that had the front turrets. But it was a workhorse, the Wellington.
Now, what sort of training flights did you do once you put your crew together?
Circuits and landings. High level bombing, that was for the bomb aimer. He used to practice on ranges out over the North Sea. For the rear gunner, air firing. If firing the guns. CNL against circuits and landings. And then I've got an item here. Sometimes the Flight Sergeant Heyman did the flying. He did his first flight after 1, 2, 3, 4 flights with another pilot. Then he did his circuits and landings. And then the next day, it appears we did a flight with Flying Officer Green as the pilot, who was checking Heyman's performance. He's just got check in the log here. And then he did circuits and landings on his own again. And then it was high level bombing. Then it was across country. Now that would be for the navigator and myself. And then we did check circuits, cross countries. And then we did what was called a corkscrew. Now for that we had a seasoned pilot. And the corkscrew...
Can you explain what it was?
Pardon?
Can you explain what it was?
Yes. This was for the gunner. And when the gunners were doing a training session, it was either firing at a drogue towed by another aircraft or using a camera gun. To register the number of hits and all this sort of thing. And here we've got something, C, camera gun. I've got CCG, and that was a camera gun. And he had to do that, and the aircraft, the Wellington, had to take avoiding action, corkscrewing, and the the gunner would be relaying to the pilot, corkscrew left, corkscrew right, and all this sort of thing. Not only did the rear gunner do that, but the mid-upper gunner did as well. Then there's another cross-country, and I've just noticed here the cross-country flights were a lot longer than the specific training for gunners and circuits and landings, of course, obviously, because it involved the navigator having to navigate, you know, a longer course and change in a lot of different directions. So then we did three cross countries took up the bulk of it. Then there's another camera gun fighter affiliation it's got here. And I had something to do with that, as far as I remember, because we had a new piece of radar equipment which was called a fish ponds.
Now, tell me about that. You said what was the fish ponds?
Well, the fish ponds was a little radar screen beside me where I could see, like, some aircraft had H2S scanners. They were scanners that gave you a photograph of the ground, a map of the ground. The one that I had was a circle, and the centre of the circle was our aircraft, and we saw other blips coming in from different angles, you know, from over above or underneath, and I had to relay this information to all the gunners. So that was the sort of thing, operational training, you see. We really needed all these things, cross countries, high-level bombing, air firing, fighter affiliation, high-level bombing and fighter affiliation, you know, the combining things. And
did you blend well together as a crew, do you think?
We did, yes. There were no problems at all, really.
So how long were you with 8402U?
I was there till at least the 19th of February, 45.
And then what?
And then to Lindholm in Yorkshire, near Doncaster. Number 1656 Heavy Bomber Conversion Unit, HBCU. Now when you mentioned about crewing up, you see there we only had 6 crew members because we did not have a flight engineer or second pilot. We picked him up at Lindholm.
Now, who was that?
It was a lad called Bill Turnbull, William Turnbull.
And another sergeant, I would presume.
He was at the time, yes. No, I think he was a flight sergeant, and I was a flight sergeant by that time.
Now, was he the flight engineer or second pilot, or is it? It's the same thing, isn't it?
Well, it's what happened to him. He went for training as a pilot in Canada, and he passed out to pilots as on mosquitoes. But there weren't the pilots needed for mosquitoes at this stage of the war. So a lot of flight engineers became second pilots, really. But they were flight engineers. They kept an eye on the instruments. They knew, you know, they could fly the aircraft and do all the things that the pilot could do.
Now, what was William Turnbull like then?
Well, he was responsible for the state I'm in now, because it's through him I met my wife. He came from the northeast here through at Felling, where my wife lived, and he was engaged to a WAF on the camp. Well, she wasn't at Lindholm, but he did meet up with her at on the squadron. He was engaged to her, and they decided that they were going to get married. She was an orphan. She had both her parents were dead. And after the war, well, it wasn't long, it was just after the war. The Japanese war hadn't finished. But in June, we were all still together on the squadron.
I'll come to that later. Now, what was Turnbull like then? Give us a pen picture.
Nice chap. He's the one I kept touch with for the longest length of time. Because
what was he like? I mean, you know,
very nice fellow. He was he'd been a cabinet maker in civilian life, and very good at his job. Very good pilot. Very conscientious fellow.
Fitted into the crew well.
Oh yes, very well. And he was a flight sergeant. Yes.
Were you socialising together as a crew? And I understand that some of the crew weren't exactly jolly. I'm not saying they weren't nice, but they weren't jolly men. No.
Yeah.
Did you socialise together generally, or did some crews do everything together? You know.
Well, apart from the skipper, from being at OTU, where we've just left, to the rest of the time we knew him. He didn't really socialise with the rest of the crew. He did eventually get his commission. He became a pilot officer while we were at Binbrook. And of course he ate in the officer's mess, and we only saw him at briefing sessions. The rest of us, when we were on the squadron, had the choice of living in the barracks.
Hang on, we're running on there, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.